You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Natasha Stagg. She's calling me from Brooklyn. Natasha, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Natasha, just to get an understanding of begin to move into your work. What are you doing now? What are you working on?
Well, I'm working on a few things. I'm working on an essay that will be published in an anthology by Sternberg Press called Intersubjectivity Volume 2. And that's just what I'm like currently working on, but I'm always working on a bunch of things. I'm writing pieces for magazines, one for the Gagosian magazine, one for The Magazine, which is where I used to be an editor, and I still write for them occasionally. I write for Dazed a lot, and I'm writing something for Spike Art Quarterly, which is a German magazine. I have a column there this summer. And then I have a day job where I write ad copy 3 days a week. So, a few things.
So you're doing an awful lot of writing. I mean, I guess to begin with, you know, there's specific ones I'd like to get into, but I'm glad you mentioned your day job, because as a writer, it's, and this has come up when I talk to, I don't know, different editors and different kinds of writers, it seems that in the last 10 years, writing has become more difficult than ever to survive on.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just in that 10 years, and correct me if I'm wrong or you see it differently, and maybe this is a New York perspective, I don't know, because we're other New Yorkers that were talking to me who were making, like, a great living as writers, published books, and then suddenly it was like the bottom fell out.
Yeah, well, I don't have the same experience because I started working in New York as a writer only 4 years ago or 5 years ago, so I don't have anything to compare it to. But yeah, when I was an editor, I would talk to writers who were a little bit older. Usually they'd moved out to Connecticut or something and, you know, tried to get away from the rat race, just because it's sort of like content world over here. You know, it's like the more you can do, the more like fluff pieces you can write, the more marketable you are, and that's just depressing for writers who had these kind of amazing lives in the 70s and 80s here, and could be taken seriously, could be given a lot of time and a lot of access to be able to write articles that weren't necessarily hard-hitting journalism, but just like fun, amazing articles, you know, like the Vanity Fair style kind of in-depth interview. And that, I don't think it happens as much anymore. A lot of, you know, Skype interviews for like less than a dollar a word. And nobody wants to do that anymore. None of the people who had it really good want to do that. I don't really know what they're doing.
Well, so, but it's what you're doing too. I mean, this is, you know, I'm really glad you mentioned that as well. You know, this idea of, you know, this is content world, whereas as you were saying, to some degree, fluff kind of reigns. But that's not what you're involved in. You're steering away from fluff, aren't you? I mean, I haven't read everything you've written,
yeah.
But it does seem to me you're that kind of writer. So you're existing in content world too. How do you navigate that? And am I right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I guess it can be done. And I think that I've made a conscious effort to not do the content creation, at least not under my own name. Once in a while, I would have to write something for the, and it would have to be very advertorial, except not, I mean, not technically, but just sort of this, like, you know, greasing wheels type of like 200-word article, and I had to publish it so I would write a pseudonym. But for the most part, I've gotten away with, I don't know how I did it, honestly, because I remember...
Well, that's what I'm asking. That's what I'm really asking, because it seems exceptional, right? You didn't grow up in that. You're aware of that whole sort of thing happening. So how did you pave your way, I think, is an important part of what supports your writing. Because we'll jump into an article soon, but just to continue with that, how did you do this? How did you navigate that, then, do you think?
I don't know. It's just my very specific life that led to this. But I think I was very, very aware of blogging when I was in college, and for some reason never got involved in it, but was very, like, interested in what it was becoming and these personalities that that lend themselves to blogs. And then to watch those same personalities sort of fail eventually and become out of style, it was like this, I guess, a wake-up call. You know, it was like those people I thought were going to be the new wave of popular writers. And that's not what happened, because eventually people stop caring about a blogger. They don't, I mean, I guess they'll always have fans, but it's, blogging is a lot more about what's in fashion, and the person itself is so involved and so much a face of the blog that if that person isn't in fashion, then the blog is not. So everything's thrown out. So I was wary of that style, and I was wary of putting my face on anything. And I think when I was starting to do freelance writing right out of college, it was a lot of sort of like SEO, like just for hire bullshit, like just, you know, writing these like how-to guides for like a place called work.com, for example. It was really funny. But I had all this kind of, I don't know, it was like blogging experience without being a blogger. And I was like, that's not for me. Like, creating content is horrifying. It's just really pulling a reader into something, even though you don't have the knowledge that they're looking for. And that's like a malicious thing to do, pretty much. But I don't know. I like learned all that somehow without being here in New York yet, and without like really having a job. And then once I got here, those were the types of jobs that people were telling me to go after and that were coming up on, like, job websites, or, like, you know, I was looking for jobs on Craigslist and everywhere else. And those were the types of jobs that people needed. It was, like, somebody who could create content, somebody who could write about, like, beauty products, and, like, every single article you would write would have a picture of your face next to it and your name in bold, and that would be your entire personality. You would have to sell yourself as this person and inside of this this corporation, and that really repulsed me too. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to like figure out.
But somehow,
how
but somehow
I got
you,
around
but somehow
it.
You navigated it. Yeah, because you're you know, I want to write, talk about what you're writing for Spike Art Quarterly or Gagosian or Days. But so you sounds like you're straddling both worlds, because you're still writing copy and able to meet that on your own terms with writing under pseudonym as well. It sounds like.
And I mean, then you're pitching copy, work. There's no name.
Right.
So that's the trade-off, and it's also, it pays much better. So,
ad copy pays the most as opposed to blogging or other things.
Huh. Yeah, I think all of that is like a weird scam or something. Like that's not gonna be able to sustain itself.
That's based on just the complete consuming culture, right? It's assuming that more ads, we're just all going to keep consuming, and the way things seem to be pitched at us on the web, in terms of shopping, it seems the way things are going, right? Is ad copy ruling in a way? And that is kind of disturbing. So let's talk about SpikeArt Quarterly and what's maybe in another piece, because there's that, right? And maybe it's not disturbing. It's what it is, right? We're in this capitalist culture that's like run amok, and where everything is like Facebook algorithms and ads, and it's how businesses are reaching their customers. So in that context, in that world, you're writing for SpikeArt Quarterly, and I don't know what you're writing for Gagosian Magazine. I didn't know there was a Gagosian Magazine. I don't know that. But
it's brand new, yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay. So maybe we should talk about those two just briefly, what you're writing for Gagosian Magazine and what that magazine is and what you're writing for SpikeArt Quarterly or thinking about writing. I know you haven't done it yet. How to approach those things.
Yeah. Well,
if you want.
I guess I'm just really lucky right now because after publishing a book that was sort of about how this consumer culture affects us, but loosely, I think I've been tapped a lot to comment on it, and that means I am not being tapped to be a part of it as much. So
let's talk about the book a little bit, just so people know. I mean, not to just plug the book, but also so people know.
Okay.
It'll be in here. But you're talking about the book that you just wrote.
Yeah. Well, it was published about a year ago, and I was writing it when I was in grad school. So I was writing it for a long time before it got published. I'm 31 now, and I was in grad school when I was 22 to 24. So I wrote a lot of it then and then a little bit later, and then it was published later after that. It took a long time. Anyway, it's about...
So it was done in parts? Is that how it got its title, or was it done in parts? How is it... Is that what you're saying?
It didn't get published in parts. But I wrote it sort of in parts, and it became a novel once I got some people to read it and let me know if it made sense or if it should be in sections. And, I kind of compiled and made it into one coherent story, and then the actual selling of the book is what took the longest amount of time.
The selling of the book, you mean convincing another publisher or agent to take interest?
Yes, because I had the book. I moved to New York. I was kind of still working on it, but I had a couple friends that worked in publishing, and I was giving them copies. And I guess that's another part of the story, is that all the people I know that work in publishing are quitting and leaving these jobs that are just so badly paying and in New York and the most expensive place to live. And it's just impossible to kind of make a living that way. So a lot of people I know are leaving publishing jobs. And so it was hard for me to get my book to a top-level editor at a publishing house through friends, which was the only way I knew how to do anything anyway, was through friends, because I don't have a kind of business mind. I don't know how to just get in there, and I didn't have an agent. So, it just took a long time, and then eventually none of the publishers that I was after I don't think any of them would have been right for it anyway, and I ended up doing I actually was writing an article for this magazine called Kaleidoscope, that's an Italian art magazine, and for that article, I interviewed Chris Krauss, who's been, like, a hero of mine for a long time, And Semiotext has been sort of this like ultimate cool circle that I never even dreamed I could be a part of. And when I interviewed Chris Kraus, who runs Semiotext, we talked about my manuscript later, and
this is for surveys, right?
Yeah, for surveys. The novel.
I just don't think we mentioned it yet in the interview that this is surveys, the book that we're discussing. So go on. So yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. And
semiotic.
Yeah, and then she read my manuscript and published it almost immediately. So it was so easy, and it's been like a total dream to have that to have the name Semiotext on my book gives it depth that I wanted it to have. I didn't want it to be this sort of fluffy coming of age like story about internet teen girl fantasy, whatever. Like, it was just like
right,
exactly the right place for it in my mind.
And that's perhaps to talk about that book, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know, that's also what allowed so many people to learn about how you wrote, and is also perhaps part of how you navigated everything that we've been talking about earlier, right? This kind of set the die in a sense for the way you can write and how you think, I would imagine, to editors all over the world, or am I overstating that, do you think?
I think so. No, I think you're right. I think that the book, the fact that it's sort of relevant and about this newer phenomenon, which is an internet persona that kind of negates or opens doors for a personality that is not necessarily the same as their internet persona. That's a new subject, and it could have been sort of just put into the same category as other kind of coming of age books, because it is a coming of age book, and it could have been put into the category of like anybody becoming famous, or like or that style of like memoir, you know, like fame memoir. But it's instead, I think what I tried to do with it was make it a little bit more about the way the internet has changed this way we think about ourselves. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I wanted it to be a little deeper than that, and I think that because Semiotext saw that in it and has explained it in the way it promoted the book that way and put it in the same category as, like, Theory of a Young Girl and Rena Spalling's and, like, other novels that they've published that are much more experimental, then it puts it in this other trajectory. And so fans of that publishing house have come to my book and said that they liked it as this like other version of, or a more accessible maybe version of these other books that are more theoretical. And that's exactly where I wanted it to go. And so, yeah, maybe after that, and even somewhat before it, I've been looking for that type of outlet, and now they keep finding me, and it's a lot of German places, actually, like German magazines, but obviously there's been Italian ones too. And I think Semiotext has a really good relationship with Italian writers, so that makes sense. And Germany is just, I think the Berlin scene is just very interested in like that exact type of academia too, the more academic
very interesting
kind of thing.
And yeah. The Gagosian magazine, what is that?
I just have a friend that works there, but I don't really know that much about the Kukosian magazine, just that it's brand new. But I just write for anybody, really, whoever asks me to.
And so, but everybody wants different things, right? I mean, just to talk about one, because we really could get into the book, which perhaps we should do in a second conversation. But Spike Art Quarterly, do you want to just talk about how you're, so when someone like that asks you for a column, as you were saying, how will that column be developed? Do you want to speak about that at all? Just to talk about how you're maybe thinking about the future that way, as it relates perhaps or not to your book and everything we've talked about in between in this content world we're in, as you say.
I don't know. Yeah, it's like it feels like I'm getting away with a lot right now because I know that everyone, for the most part, is expected to write this content. But I guess I write content for my day job, and then I write whatever I want for other magazines and. It feels like I'm living in the New York 80s scene that I was kind of dreaming of, and I don't know how that happened, but I was just in Berlin actually a week ago, and I was there to do a couple readings, and so I met with an editor at Spike, and we had coffee and discussed this column, and his idea was that Marguerite Duras wrote a column in 1980, in the summer of 1980, that was for a French magazine. And their suggestion to her was to write one entry every day for a year, and her suggestion back was to write one entry every week for a summer. So, and she said she could, it had to be with about whatever she wanted and as long or as short as she wanted it to be. And so this editor at Spike told me that his suggestion to me was to write one entry every week for a summer, the same way she did. So it's as long or as short as I want it to be and about anything. And,
that's amazing. I mean, that is like the 80s dream. Very unusual, right? I mean, I'm glad we spoke about that one because I can't imagine every editor saying that to you, right, or anything close.
No,
that seems
not
so
at
European
all.
And cool and, you know.
Yeah, most of the time when I get an assignment, it's like, here's, you know, the manager and the publicist and the agent of this celebrity, and here's the time, and here's the like call-in number, and here's what you have to do, and here's all the research that you have. You know, it's like a lot of. It's actually like way more work than what it ends up paying, no matter what. Even if the job is $1 a word, which is it's kind of rare now. I think that older writers always demand $1 a word, and they should because that's what they got paid in the 80s. But or the 90s or whatever, but they but people don't really pay $1 a word anymore, and even when they do, the work that goes into writing, for example, a celebrity interview, is so much more than, I mean, if you kind of parse out the hours, it's worth way more than what they pay you always. It's a really time-consuming job. So that's why I don't think a lot of people can really do it. They have to have other jobs at the same time. I mean, I'm also
super lucky. Which is how you navigate it. I'm sorry, go on. You're also super lucky because of what?
Well, yeah, that's how I navigate it. I'm lucky because my day job is only 3 days a week. Mm. And that's another thing that I magically, fell into. So, I have
That's ad copy under a pseudonym, or your name isn't even on ad copy.
Right. It's. I mean, I work for a creative consultancy, and it's like an office job with meetings and deadlines, all that, like writing press releases and strategies for social media and, you know, for brands, for advertising. So that's like a real, like, 9 to 5. And then for the rest of the week, I am allowed to do these jobs that don't pay enough. And it's kind of funny because they're not, it's not like such a joy, you know, to be able to do them. But I do think it's part of staying relevant as a writer. You kind of have to keep doing those assignments for magazines. I might be wrong. I might not have, I don't know.
I mean, because it keeps you in touch with something, a world outside of maybe like the arts and academia, which can be its own kind of bubble. I mean, that's just maybe my thought, really, as opposed to the magazine world and all these other intersecting worlds out there, really.
That's true. I've learned so much from having this job that I wouldn't have known, and all of it informs everything else. You know, learning about advertising helps you know about creating content, and creating content helps you know about writing your own for yourself.
Right. Well, it's also that's very well put, and it's nice to kind of come close to an ending on that. I mean, it also seems that it's given you a certain kind of freedom. One thing that I, which is kind of like the 80s dream, as I interpret it, what you're saying, or the idea of that, the artist that, I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people on this, and I often see the situations where people are happiest, you know, which yours appears to be, right, artistically, is that they've had some kind of job that wasn't so taxing, that allowed them to do anything they want, like what you're doing for Spike Art Quarterly, you know, whether mm-hmm. it's paid or not. You know, I mean, you happen to be getting paid for that. There's, but just the idea of having a day job that's not so taxing and allows you to live in a place like New York where you can have enough free time to do what you like.
Seems yeah.
to be what's really lucky.
I mean, I'm really lucky, and I also should say that I worked for the whole time I've been here up until like earlier this year, late last year, the whole time I've lived in New York, I was living paycheck to paycheck. And if that, you know, like I usually didn't have rent on time because I was working for a magazine and freelancing on top of that. And that wasn't working. It wasn't enough, and I don't live in like an apartment by myself in the West Village. I live with roommates in Brooklyn, very far away from the city, and it's still, that doesn't work. And that's another weird thing that you end up learning about the city or this industry, that's it's just not the way it was before, because really only people who start out with a lot of money can survive in it.
Can survive in Manhattan? Are you making a distinction between Brooklyn and Manhattan there? Like
yeah,
that,
yeah.
You said that,
is
that what? Is, but I didn't follow that last thing. So only the people that have money, you said that didn't work out, like the idea of having the Brooklyn set up and or commuting.
Oh, no, it didn't work out financially for me to be working at a magazine full time.
Right.
And even with like the cheap apartment that I live in, cheap room in a cheap apartment that I live in, I still didn't make enough money to like really live the life that I think I'm like supposed to live, you know, because
right.
Another part of working in magazines is that you're kind of required to act like you have money and go to fancy parties and dress nicely. And it's just like a big joke, because I'm an example, like I didn't have any money at all moving to New York. I didn't save up before I got here. I just kind of got here and then started working in magazines, and I never had enough money to basically work in a magazine. I never got past a certain point where I wasn't really worried about money and where I could spend something on like a nice outfit. And a huge part of that job was looking good. So it's just,
Right. It's
funny because I think I did fine. I mean, I became the editor of that magazine and I was totally like respected and I wouldn't have traded it for anything because I learned a lot and I made great friends and I loved being there. But it also, there was just this like fear constantly gripping me of like, where am I going to get the next paycheck? I have to like do something else on top of this really taxing job in order to survive in New York. That's right. Why I don't know how it's going to work out. Like, I don't know how any of these places are going to continue when that's the way it is there. They just don't have the money anymore and they can't pay the writers anymore. They can't pay anybody.
You're talking about all the magazines, especially print magazines, not agencies like the one you're working for. You're talking about where
agencies are doing fine.
Right, they're doing fine, but the direction of all the magazines, the print magazines, that
I'm talking specifically about print fashion magazines.
Right.
I don't have any experience in other types of magazines, like in their offices. So that's all I know about.
Well, it's interesting. How that's all moving and changing. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now. A question I ask everybody that's kind of off topic. Could be anything at all, but what are you reading at the moment?
I'm actually reading a book that I read a long time ago. I think I was in high school when I first read it, and I'm really glad that I'm reading it again. It's called Edie by Jean Stein, about Edie Sedgwick. And I remembered it because Jean Stein recently passed away, tragically. And she is, I think she kind of invented this style of oral history that is the way this book is written. So it's just interviews with people who knew Edie Sedgwick, and it's like the most amazing book. It really... Like, you can tell that she didn't edit out any of these people's mannerisms, and it's just great.
Natasha, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work. Thank you.
Thanks so much. That was fun.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.